From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. The center recently sponsored a discussion of philosophy and its contributions to public policy, with attention to issues such as abortion, affirmative action, and professional ethics. The speakers are James Rachels, Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences and Professor of Philosophy at the University of Alabama in Birmingham; George Schur, a scholar at the National Humanities Center and a professor of philosophy at the University of Vermont; William Bennett, the director of the center; and Stephen Kahn, associate director of the Humanities Division at the Rockefeller Foundation.
Being a moral agent isn't anything very abstruse here. Mm-hmm. We're talking about someone who considers arguments on both sides and makes up his own mind when mm-hmm. questions of right and wrong are concerned. Mm-hmm. Now, one can't avoid thinking about issues of public policy simply by turning over these matters to elected representatives. It would be nice if we could do that. But how are we to assess the performance of those representatives? How are we to decide whom to vote for? The politicians make speeches and say of one another, well, my opponent is too soft on criminals. My opponent is wants to give away your hard-earned tax money to welfare loafers. My opponent favors busing children across town for purposes of racial balance, and I'm going to fight to let your kids go to the school nearest your own home, and so forth and so on. If a citizen does not inform himself or herself about these issues and think things through and come to some reasoned judgments of his own, then he's just going to be hostage to demagoguery. He's going to cast his vote just on the basis of who makes the most powerful appeal to emotion. Here's an example of a kind of issue that I would be willing to leave to the experts, and it's a very important issue. Nuclear power. That's an issue on which I think philosophy can contribute very little, because the question of whether to go with nuclear power plants or not depends so much on just sheer factual information that I, as a philosopher, don't feel particularly competent to judge about. I think it's an issue where it's the means to achieve a certain end that's at stake more than anything else. So I'm willing to leave that to the experts, so to speak, whereas I'm not willing to leave questions about, say, school busing to achieve racial balance to the experts. There are no good philosophical papers on the issue of nuclear power, none that I'm aware of. There are lots of philosophical papers on abortion and reverse discrimination and all the rest of it. As far as I can tell, there are no philosophical issues connected with the nuclear power debate in the way there are with the others.
Let me suggest two.
Obligation to future generations.
That's one. The waste disposal issue. Pretty clearly those wastes are going to be with us for many, many thousands of years. And I think one question that arises is just what sorts of obligations do we have to fairly distant generations in regard to them. Another question that arises connected with that is the question of how we're supposed to think about tiny risks of great catastrophe, because that's what the opponents of nuclear power are worried about. Suppose you have two policies, one of which gives you a tiny risk of a horrible catastrophe, and the other gives you a virtual certainty of some fairly serious but livable with harms. One possibility here is that the way to think about this is to multiply the magnitude of the catastrophe times the probability of its occurring, so that the two possibilities may turn out to be exactly the same. Another way to think about it is to give, let's say, more weight to greater catastrophes, to larger catastrophes, even though the probability of their occurring is very small. It seems to me that turning the experts loose, and by that I mean all kinds of experts, mathematical experts, nuclear energy experts, is not going to solve that kind of problem. I don't know if a philosopher is going to solve it either, but I bet you a philosopher has a better chance than the other experts.
I take it back. I was exaggerating to say that there are no philosophical problems here. You've described one very nice philosophical problem connected with this. The other philosophical problems that you mentioned seemed to me, well, obligations to future generations, for example. It comes up in connection with lots of environmental questions, and it's a familiar issue. What bothers me about the debate over nuclear energy is that even though there are problems of a sort that you mentioned, philosophical problems, still those problems come up only after one has decided what to think about the facts in the case. How great is the danger connected with the disposal of the radioactive waste? How great is the danger of a catastrophe at a power plant and so forth? And those are really crucial questions, and they're questions to which I just have no idea what the answers are.
Now, why is that different from saying that questions about, let's say, whether or not it's unjust to practice preferential hiring only come up after you figured out the answer to the factual question of whether preferential hiring is going to make the victims of past discrimination whole or is going to create a more equal society or something like that? I mean, aren't those factual questions that have to be answered before the normative questions can get started by your reckoning? I think you may have a greater faith in social science than I do.
Yeah.
Maybe my faith is just simply in my own intuitions. I don't know.
It is interesting, though, Jim. I mean, I think in this one, it's true in affirmative action and nuclear power, you get sort of opposite ends of the spectrum. Nuclear power, I think lots of philosophers have feared to tread, although I think they could enter usefully at points because of their sense of the, you know, sort of just overwhelming array of facts. The opposite thing happened, I think, with the affirmative action debate. Everybody was one of those things where everybody immediately had an opinion about it, sort of like pornography or sex education. Everybody just sort of jumped in and started. And I noticed that I was involved in the debate and wrote some things on it, that people entered this debate, you know, when we were talking about the Bakke case and things, with a wonderful disregard of what seemed to me to be relevant facts. I survey audiences on this, to return to this. I said, what do you think the facts in this case are? And people would say, well, you know, we talk about the Miss Medical School where this guy's trying to get in, and here's this fellow, and he's got very good grades and very good scores. And there are these other people who are trying to get in. They are minorities, blacks, and their scores aren't quite so good. And I'd say, what do you think they are? And they'd say, well, this guy's somewhere in the 90s, and these folks are somewhere in the 80s. And in fact, Bakke was up in the mid-90s in average of all his tests, and the people admitted under the affirmative action plan at that medical school were in the low 30s. And that used to surprise people. And they used to say, oh, well, that makes a difference. We thought they were sort of closer or not. But I guess caution both ways. One maybe should not fear to tread in areas where one may have to study a lot, and on the other hand, where one immediately feels, because it's a highly charged emotional issue, that one has the answer, that one goes in disregard of the facts.
I want to say one more.
I think my facts are right there. I may not be exactly right, but they're very close.
I want to say one more thing about the relevance of philosophy to setting public policy in this area. There is public policy in the United States on the question of affirmative action, reverse discrimination, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
That policy has been set by such agencies as the Office of Equal Opportunity, OEO, and by the Supreme Court, and by other court decisions. Let's think for just a moment about that decision of the Supreme Court in the Bakke case. Alan Bakke applied for admission to the University of California Medical School and was refused. At the same time, less qualified applicants from minority groups were admitted. Bakke challenged this, said this had violated his constitutional rights. his case was decided by the Supreme Court in his favor. What's the relation between philosophical thinking about reverse discrimination and the Supreme Court decision in this case? The answer is that the Supreme Court decision is philosophy. It's not just related to philosophy. If you read the opinion of the Supreme Court in the Bakke case, what you read is a philosophical essay, almost indistinguishable from some of the kinds of writings that philosophers have done on this issue in the legal journals. Now, many people, I sometimes ask my students to read some high court decisions on matters like reverse discrimination, abortion, and so forth. Mm-hmm. And they're almost always surprised by what they find in these decisions. Mm-hmm. I think they imagine that the law works like this. You can't drive over 55 miles an hour on the highway. You are going 57 miles an hour. Therefore, you're guilty. Case is against you. Mm-hmm. They have a simple model of the law in their mind where there are clear rules. The court decides whether you're in violation of that rule. If you are, then you're penalized in some way. It's not what happens in cases where constitutional issues are at stake. The Constitution contains some rather vague phrases about equal protection of the laws, about the due process of the law. These phrases are taken by the courts to protect those of the general rights of citizens. Whether or not the rights of citizens are violated, have been violated, will be considered by the court in a kind of general philosophical way. Mm-hmm. So we find that a lot of philosophy is done in the appeals courts in the United States and published in legal decisions.
Are there excessive demands being made of philosophers or philosophy today? I guess I'm really asking two questions. Are excessive demands being made, and are the demands of being made, is this good for philosophy and its health as a discipline or not? What's your sense?
I'm tempted to say that it's not the demands placed on philosophers, but the claims made by philosophers that are excessive. Philosophers who go into these questions as though they are going to provide these answers, forgetting, I think, a couple of crucial factors. First, what we mentioned earlier, the importance of the facts. If you're going to deal with a question of public policy, invariably there will be key facts that are in dispute with regard to that policy. One fact that is in dispute with regard to affirmative action is what has been the effect of affirmative action policies. Studies are presently being done and commissioned to look at the effects of affirmative action precisely because these are in dispute. So if you're going to venture into the public policy arena, I think it's incumbent upon you to have a thorough acquaintance with the facts, at least whatever is available to you in that way, and philosophers often do not bother sufficiently to get hold of those facts before they venture in with opinions. A second problem is that public policy questions have to be decided at a particular time. Perhaps it's today, tomorrow, next week, or next year. There has to be a decision. Academic questions go on for generations. Questions about rights will continue on as long as there are philosophers to discuss matters of political philosophy and ethics. There will be questions raised about rights. Nevertheless, the government has to take a certain an action. That action has to be taken within a reasonable amount of time. We have to come to a decision. And often the philosopher is not the best person to help us arrive at this decision because the philosopher is willing to let the debate go on for very long. In fact, it's in the nature of the subject that the debate should continue and alternatives should not be dismissed before they have been thoroughly examined. But from the point of view of public policy, perhaps an alternative has got to be dismissed in order to get on to some conclusion. Right. I think there's a danger for the philosopher in becoming too concerned with the issue of public policy, answering today's question, but by so doing providing no answer to tomorrow's question. And I think the best philosophers have provided enlightenment, not for the day or for the week or even for the year, but for centuries.
Well, I guess I'm treading on maybe some dangerous ground. I certainly don't want to deny what you say about the timeless questions being the special province of philosophy. On the other hand, I do think that the timely questions often give us a pretty good way into the timeless questions. If you start off by asking whether bars should throw out transvestites, then you're naturally going to be led to ask the question, what exactly is wrong with being a transvestite? Why is that way of living your life a less good way of living your life than some other way? And you're going to be led directly into questions of just what kind of life is preferable and why.
From the National Humanities Center, this has been an excerpt from a discussion of philosophy and public policy. The speakers were Stephen Kahn, Associate Director of the Humanities Division at the Rockefeller Foundation, George Schur, a professor of philosophy at the University of Vermont and a scholar at the National Humanities Center, William Bennett, Director of the Center, and James Rachels, Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences and Professor of Philosophy at the University of Alabama in Birmingham. From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. How do you measure the value of an idea, of the notions and concepts central to societies or civilizations? Historians of ideas attempt to measure the worth of the individual life, for instance, or of humankind's relationship to the natural world. Here's Professor John Passmore, a recent visitor at the National Humanities Center, who teaches at the Australian National University in Canberra. Joining in the conversation is Kent Mulliken, my colleague at the National Humanities Center.
Your book about the history of our ideas about nature, it's called Man's Responsibility Towards Nature, I believe, is fascinating, makes great reading. Is it more? Do you think, having written the book, that it contributed to the way people since the book have made policy about nature? Do you have any reason to believe that your book has made a difference?
That's something one can never be sure about, because one never knows, apart from anything else, who's been reading the book or who's heard other people talking about the book or who has read reviews of the book, which is the way in which many people get acquainted with books nowadays. I can't be sure. It has certainly led to a flourishing intellectual study of environmental ethics, of moral problems affecting man's relationship to the environment. I think I was the first philosopher to talk extensively about these questions. But how far it's affected practical conduct, I don't know. The book was reviewed by a number of people, like in England, C.P. Snow, who do, and by Lord Ashby, who do have contact with political life. And again, one simply doesn't know how far it floats through such people to administrators.
How did you approach this problem?
In that particular case, I looked first at the historical roots of our thinking about the environment, and then I went on to ask a number of general questions about why we should bother about preserving wildernesses at all, about what degree of responsibility we have for the future, about the economic and social effects of trying to control pollution, about the moral questions involved in population control. So there, the historical background was meant to suggest, again, that we've tended to think along certain lines on account of our Greek and Christian inheritance, and we may need to rethink a good many of these issues.
Recently, the present Secretary of the Interior of the United States made what has become a very notorious statement. He was asked, should we not worry about preserving our environment for future generations? And he replied, well, I'm not sure how many future generations there will be before the Lord returns. What is the origin of that response?
It was, for a time, in a broader implication, a fairly general one. It used to be presumed, for example, that you didn't have to worry about the possible disappearance of species because species would be preserved by God, and that they wouldn't be allowed to disappear, so that human beings didn't have any particular responsibility.
Now, who made these assumptions?
Churchmen? Were made by theologians.
Not by scientists?
By religious thinkings, no. And of course this was before the work on geology, the work on disappearing fossil species and so on. But it was quite widely presumed. Again, it was for some time presumed that population would always be kept under control in the same way, that no species would be allowed to outgrow itself. It's only very recently that we've thought of human beings as having any particular responsibility towards nature at all. Even the idea that you oughtn't to be cruel to animals is one that very few people accepted until fairly late into the 19th century. It's felt that in relation to nature, human beings had no moral responsibility at all. And we've now put a great weight on human beings because we've learnt just how destructive we can be, and more with our growing technology, but even through history, how destructive human beings have been. And now, for the first time, really, we have to face the question, what is our responsibility to future generations? The question that the minister that was taken up here in the cabinet. It wasn't ever a question we had to ask, because it was widely assumed that human beings had neither the power, nor the capacity, nor the need to concern themselves about future generations.
Well, it was also a political issue, was it not? In the sense of there was just no need to worry about things like that. There was the business of the world was at hand. And
yes, there was, it was thought, no need to worry about it. And that was right enough over a long period of time anyhow. What human beings could do was relatively limited, and certainly never before, for example, have human beings been in a position in which they could conceivably destroy the entire human race.
Professor Passmore, are you optimistic about humanity's moral relationship to nature? Is it possible for nature and business, people, business, what people do, to flourish together?
Yes, I think so. There really has been a big change there. I thought at first, particularly as it was often associated with a lot of very loose thinking, I thought the environmental movement and environmental emphases might die out with a great many other ideas that died out in the early 1970s, and especially under the economic pressures that there have been since. But I don't think this is true. I think people have become aware of the environment as a permanent ingredient in their thinking. Like anything else, it will be overcome at time by other considerations. We have mixed obligations, mixed responsibilities. But so far as I can see now, it's got fixed into the Western consciousness that we can be very destructive, that we can destroy ourselves, that we can destroy the world around us, and the things that we oughtn't to do at this level.
The way people look at nature, has it changed much? What are the major changes?
Well, one thing I think is that we've recognized the enormous complexity of natural processes. We thought at one time that if we destroyed a species, let us say, well, we destroyed a species and that was that. But now we've discovered that in destroying a particular species, we can destroy a whole chain of life in which that species played a part, and that you've got to be very, very careful that everything you do in relation to nature has totally unexpected consequences, things you couldn't anticipate at all. Who would have guessed that hurling a bit of mercury into the sea, quite safely it would seem, off Japan, that this would finally end up again on people's dinner plates and be consumed by children and produce the dreadful Minamata disease? Nobody thought of nature in these terms. That's one thing that's come home to us very, very forcibly.
Has it been a case of villainy, deliberate pollution of the environment?
It's been a mixture. In the case I'm just thinking about in Japan, even when the dangers were apparent, the firm in question was very reluctant to give up its practices. And sometimes people have, I think, been criminally careless in the disposal of chemical waste and physical waste of one sort and another, where they must have known that they'd caused trouble. A lot of it hasn't been at all. There's a great deal that we didn't realize, didn't know about the impact of what we were doing on natural processes. After all, we've introduced, since the chemical industry got underway, we've introduced thousands and thousands of new chemical products into the atmosphere, things that nature, natural processes, were not used to dealing with. And inevitably, some of these will have very startling consequences upon us. The starting point was a book written by an American diplomat in the 19th century on man's destructiveness. He looked at it historically and saw what terrible things human beings had done to the world in earlier historical periods. But even Plato had noticed this. He'd noticed that there were islands in Greece where there used to be shrines set up to the rivers, and the rivers were not there anymore. The trees had been cut down, the rivers had disappeared, and the whole place had become dry. So that, in a sense, human beings have had some consciousness of their destructiveness. But they didn't really think of things like insecticides. After all, you tended to think, well, insecticide is there to kill a very tiny thing like a mosquito. How could it possibly have any harmful effects on human beings?
What about the notion of the noble savage, the tribesmen, the aborigines, the Indians, that sort of thing? Are they really as much in tune with the environment as popular myth would have them?
Well, we've discovered that in Australia that there was a great deal of destructiveness resulting from the lighting of fires by aborigines in order to drive animals into particular areas, and in some other ways. But it's such a nomadic society doesn't have great powers of destruction under its control, and it does need to have a certain respect for the continued existence of the species it's hunting, or otherwise it will completely die out. It can't. If it wipes out a particular species, then its food supplies are automatically affected. But basically, I think, is that they really didn't have all that much power.
Professor Passmore, what kind of a grade would you give Americans in the 20th century in terms of their relationship to nature?
Well, I don't much like grading countries, but pretty obviously there's been some very bad examples of destructiveness. And on the other hand, there's latterly been, I think, a much greater consciousness of the issues. But it comes very hard on Americans because America was the example par excellence of a technological civilization. It also comes very hard, as it happens, on communist countries like Russia, because they again sought to be technological civilizations, and some of the environmental destruction in the Soviet Union has been very extensive indeed, and only recently has there been any serious reflection on it. But it stands to reason that any country that wants to introduce a great deal of technological innovation is going to have problems in its relationship with nature. It was very apparent indeed in Japan too, as they came into their technological age.
Professor John Passmore was a recent visitor at the National Humanities Center. Professor Passmore teaches in the History of Ideas unit at the Australian National University in Canberra. He's the author of Man's Responsibility for Nature, Ecological Problems and Western Traditions, published in 1974.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina 27709. Director of the center is William Bennett. Soundings is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join me this week for a varied program on Soundings. How can philosophy and philosophers contribute to public understanding of issues like nuclear power or affirmative action? A conversation this week on Soundings provides some answers to that question.
Also featured will be a discussion of humankind's relationship to the natural world from historical and cultural perspectives. I hope you'll be listening this week for Soundings.